I'm Shelley Schlender. This is KGNU. Today we're going to look into the leading killer in America. It's heart disease. You don't want heart disease. You want a healthy heart. Maybe a heart that sounds like this. That's some interpretation of healthy heart sounds by local musicians. This is the sound of blood flowing through arteries, which we hope are healthy. Heart, arteries, blood vessels, it's all part of your cardiovascular system. How do you tell if this vital part of you is doing okay? A lot of people try to figure it out by going to their doctor or to a Channel 9 health fair, where one of the most popular tests offered is what else? The cholesterol test.
I promise not to scream too loud. So I've got some blood flow here, but it's real slow. It's a small needle and it's a big tube, so it's going to take a little while to fill. But
going, I'm fine.
Does a cholesterol test really tell you whether your cardiovascular system is okay? Actually, leading experts disagree. And it's because a lot of people who have high cholesterol never get a heart attack or stroke. And plenty of people with normal or even low cholesterol still get heart attacks, like this Boulder County man who has asked to remain anonymous. How long ago was this?
I was afraid you were going to ask me that. Six years ago, I think. All right, so are you ready? I was pretty healthy. My cholesterol was only like 200 or less. At that time, I lived in the mountains on Magnolia Road up west of Boulder. And I was bringing my daughter down the mountain to school. I did this every morning. So I wasn't feeling so great that morning, is my recollection. But I was
Our anonymous heart attack survivor says he was not feeling well. You know where this is going. But let's set the stage with our local musicians interpreting what they think the sound is of a heart that's in trouble. And for more medically based symptoms of a heart attack, let's hear from the key medical experts, the ones who usually reach the victim first. That's a Pridemark ambulance.
We've got long spine boards here. There's our heart monitor. Uniform in every ambulance.
That's Gentel Benish, who was a Pridemark paramedic at the time of this interview. Benish says she became an emergency medical tech for a very personal reason.
It's kind of a sad story. I watched paramedics try to resuscitate my grandmother, and I wanted to know what they did and did right and what they did wrong. So I went to school. It was one of the classes. I went to EMT school. And then I came and I worked for Pridemark, got hired on here at Pridemark, and absolutely fell in love with the profession. I fell in love with this company. The people are great. Everybody has a huge heart. The protocols are terrific. Our physicians are terrific. So I decided to stay in it and took that next step and became a paramedic.
Benny says she's seen a lot of heart attacks and saved a lot of people because she got to them in time.
Yeah. The sooner you get help, the better off you are. You know, and even if it's not cardiac, I tell my patients, you're better safe than sorry.
It's a $500 bill, though.
I think that's worth a heart.
She's also seen a lot of people where it's just too late.
I'm there because they call me, and it's very distressing to me when they don't call and they wait, and then it's too late to do any good. Of course, I'll still try, and I'll leave it to the physicians for the diagnosis and to see exactly the extent of the damage and whatnot. But if they wait, we call it time is muscle. And if you wait too long, that muscle's going to die and we can't do anything for you.
As for how common heart attacks are, she says one out of every six calls for 911 is someone who thinks they're having a heart attack. Out of those, one in five really are. Some of the symptoms?
You know, we find a patient who we'll say is lying on the floor. They're awake, they're talking to us, but they appear to be very ill. They're cool, they're pale, they're clammy.
Is there hope for this person?
There is. There's hope for this person. They're complaining of chest pain. It's been going on, we'll say, for 3 hours.
Is that typical that people wait that long?
It varies. Some people call within 10 minutes and some people will wait days. You know, it's frustrating at times, but so they've had chest pain for 3 hours. Feels like an elephant is sitting on their chest. It radiates into their neck and into their back. Feels just like their last heart attack.
Hear that then.
Yeah, we'll hear that. You know, that's one of the red flags or the catchphrases we listen for. Same with the pressure on the chest. It feels like an elephant or a car is on my chest, that sort of thing. A little bit of difficulty breathing, nausea. You know, they just don't look good. They look sick. And they've got the cardiac or the chest pain complaint.
For our anonymous heart attack survivor, let's recall that he was feeling lousy.
And so he wasn't feeling so great that morning.
Will be directed to put the heart monitor on.
He was making a 30-minute drive to bring his kids from their home way up in the foothills on Magnolia Road down to Boulder so that they could go to school. He was feeling bad. Who knows? He might have already been sweaty, gray-looking, clammy.
And I dropped her off at school, and I was feeling pain in my left arm and in my neck, I think. I don't remember exactly. It was a typical symptom. And I dropped her off at school, and I was in somewhat a lot of discomfort. I said to myself, and I don't know why, but I said to myself, I'm having a heart attack. I realized that I was having a heart attack. And so I drove straight across Aurora to 28th Street. I said, I'll drive myself to the hospital.
At this point, the hospital was 15 minutes away.
And then I got to the frontage road. You know, I'm driving towards the university. Aurora dead ends. I got to the frontage road and I said, no, I'm not. I won't be able to make it. So I turned right. I went into the Motel 8. So I pulled into the parking lot of the Motel 8. I got out of my car. I walked into the lobby of the motel. I went up to the counter and I said, call 911. I'm having a heart attack. And I went over and I laid down on a couch right there in the lobby, and I waited, and the guy called. I mean, he was shocked, I suppose. I don't remember exactly. He called. Then I got back up again. I remember I told him to call my wife and tell her. And then I went back and laid down again and waited.
Back with the PrideMark emergency tech, Janelle Benish. She says this man did the right thing by having the hotel staff call 911 while he laid down.
Absolutely. Any decrease in stress is going to help.
Oh, so after someone calls 911, instead of pacing the room and wringing their hands and shrieking and yelling, if they started practicing some yoga despite the heart pain, I mean, how do you do that?
Well, it's not so much, I'm not going to say do anything that's exertional, because any exertion will strain the heart.
Yoga then is not okay. Meditation would be okay. And prayer.
I would say just sit quietly. Focus on your breathing. Dispatch will hopefully be on the phone with you. Fire dispatch, our dispatch, whichever dispatch you're in the 911 dispatch area for. And they'll be walking you through some things, trying to help you remain calm, that sort of thing. They'll actually help you or family members do CPR. They'll help with all kinds of things. It's a matter of just listening to them and understanding that you're talking to these people. The ambulance has already been dispatched.
Luckily for our heart attack victim, at this hotel, ambulance help was just a few minutes away. But sometimes even that's not quick enough. Sometimes a heart attack stops the heart immediately. The ET crew arrives to find someone not breathing. PrideMark's Jontel Benish says that even before helping someone breathe, the most important thing is pumping the heart and pumping it hard to get the heart free from toxin.
It's clearing out a lot of the junk that
yes.
It's a higher energy tissue, so it's going to be a place where more toxins build up.
Right, right. And so what you're doing is you're moving everything out and circulating, and then when we shock, it actually has more effect. When we push epinephrine, it has more effect because you're not fighting the toxins, you're not fighting the buildup of the carbon dioxide, and you're not fighting everything.
Carbon dioxide?
Yes, carbon dioxide.
Global warming?
Yes.
Kind of ironic, isn't it?
It is, yes.
Oh, okay. So it's the carbon dioxide that is killing the heart, is the fact that it's stuck there and it's not leaving the atmosphere of the heart, if you will.
Correct.
But at that point, you look for the basic vital signs. If their heart isn't beating, you start. Do you use one of your shocker things to make their heart start up again?
If it's not beating, if it's a flat line like you're seeing on the screen right now, we'll continue CPR. And do compressions. Electricity does not help this.
Meaning that the only way to keep the heart moving is to have you be bashing at it with your fists.
Yeah, basically, doing chest compressions with two hands, no less than 100 a minute, and just continue that going. We start that for 2 minutes, and then we move down our algorithm. Depending on what we see, what needs to be done. Hopefully an IV will be established next. We've dropped an airway at that point. We're breathing for the patient, give medications that are called for.
And so you may have a machine that helps them breathe. You don't actually do the breathing for them, mouth to mouth.
We actually have a bag valve mask that we hook up to our tubes or our King Airways, and we'll breathe for them.
But when you do the pumping with your hands, that has to be you doing it.
Right.
Nobody alone can pump this hard for more than about a minute, so emergency workers take turns.
We have help on scene. It'll be more than just the paramedic and the EMT or the two paramedics on scene. We'll have the help of the fire department and police officers who also co-respond with us.
What I've heard is that that's so strenuous that, first of all, you can't keep doing it. It's too exhausting for one person.
Correct.
And the other is that it has to be strongly enough done that quite often you break the sternum.
Yes, that's actually a regular occurrence. The sternum and ribs. So,
does it save some people?
It has, yes. Yes, it's. I can't give you numbers right now. I wish I would have looked them up, but it has done a lot of good for a lot of people.
While they're pumping, they're also preparing a device that's about the size of a sewing machine. It's available in some busy places, like shopping malls or airports, for you to use in the event that someone keels over with a heart attack.
It's a defibrillator.
If someone should go into a lethal arrhythmia, known as ventricular tachycardia, ventricular fibrillation. Once applied, patient appears to be in cardiac arrest. Anybody in the general public can apply these AEDs.
Now that's for somebody whose heart is beating, but it's beating so chaotically or so fast, the blood is going every which way, not really circulating.
Right. It's just pooling is basically what it's doing. It's the heart is beating so fast that it can't pump, or it's just quivering in the chest, okay, and the patient is not getting any blood flow. They won't have a pulse in one of those rhythms, potentially both of those rhythms, and they'll present as cardiac arrest. So what happens is we'll use the airport as a perfect example. They have AEDs all over the place. General public can come into the, go grab one of the AEDs for...
Oh, my gosh, I just noticed that this panel here of directions, it says on, but it also has a bright red shock. Mm-hmm. So this is actually defibrillator unit 2?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, our heart monitors have defibrillator capability. And what happens is when a paramedic is using this machine, we actually will look and read the rhythms and treat based on that. And then we have the ability to work these buttons over here. The EMTs or the layperson level, what will happen is someone will be laying on the floor. They'll go get the defibrillator. They'll come in. That's how we manually control the jewels and stuff like that.
You mean how strong the shock is going to be?
Correct, correct.
Is this more or less than an electric fence?
It's just a big zap, yeah, basically.
Like a taser to your heart.
Yeah, it could be, yeah. That's a good way to describe it.
Okay, it says push shock button.
Mm-hmm. And we'll push the shock button.
Now, if we were touching this, we would have known it gave a shock.
Correct.
In the movies and on TV, they always have a good kind of whomp sound. Because the person's body kind of, is that true that the person's body will kind of thump?
It will. It'll jump off the floor a lot of times. And typically when we're shocking someone, we'll be like, I'm clear, you're clear, everybody's clear, shock.
Now, I do feel a little tingle in the air. Am I just imagining that, or are we close enough that there's a bit of tingle? Maybe my equipment's picking it up.
You might be. I'm not sure. I've been around it for so.
You're not noticing anything,
no,
though.
I'm not.
Analyzing now. Stand clear. Shock advised. Stand clear. Push to shock.
And that's what an automated AED or an AED
Start
sounds like
CPR.
In the public.
Wow. That had a serious voice.
Mm-hmm. It will walk anybody through everything they need to do.
And so if you see one of these in a public area, somebody who doesn't know anything about this could do it.
Correct. It'll have the patches on our patches. It shows where to place them.
Looks like you place them
right just anterior chest and left mid-axillary region or posterior or sometimes even under the left breast or pectoralis muscle.
And fortunately, there are pictures.
Yeah, there are pictures. And the AEDs a lot of times come equipped with those pictures as well.
This must be a tense moment when you need to do this.
It can be. It is, especially at first when you're new doing this sort of thing, and or depending on the circumstances, if you're in the general public, whatnot. But as time goes by, the more experienced you get, the less you pay attention to that kind of stuff. And
you have to kind of put yourself in a dispassionate mode and just think, I'm just doing my job right now.
You disconnect. I wouldn't say dispassionate, but you disconnect. So you turn the emotion itself off until you get your job done, until you get everything done that you need to do for this patient. It's very hard to stay connected in a situation where you have a grieving family and a grieving spouse or grieving kids. It's very heartbreaking at times.
And you have to keep yourself from being distracted, though, so
yes.
That you can do this as concisely as possible.
Correct. To maintain the professionalism and the degree or the level of care that we are basically counted on to administer, you have to do an emotional disconnect.
But what you just said,
push,
that...
analyze. Analyzing now. Stand clear. Shock advised.
And that was just 2 minutes of CPR in between each shock.
Stand clear. Push to shock. Start CPR.
Okay, so it actually tells you what to do to keep this going. Mm-hmm. Well, and you're doing all of this not with a reporter interviewing you, and just hypothetically, there's a body there. This is a person that you may help live, or this person may die. The family is in hysterics, most likely. Mm-hmm. And then sometimes you save this life, and sometimes you can't.
Correct, yeah.
And then what do you do?
It just depends. A lot of times I'll go talk to the family. If we're not going to transport the patient, or if we're not going to continue efforts because we're not getting any reaction from the heart whatsoever, a lot of times we'll leave that patient on scene, and the police department will be there and the fire department will be there. And I'll go down and I'll explain what I did. I'll talk to the family, let them know that I did everything within my means and within my power, and that I work underneath a physician, and they would have done the exact same thing in the ER. And, you know, I ask them if they have any questions, and I'll generally give them a business card in case they do. That way they can call me or call our administration.
Do they call you sometimes?
I have gotten calls, yes.
Is it people looking for closure?
Yeah, I think so. Very sad instances. Every year on the anniversary of a woman's husband's death, she would call me and just ask me to go through it again. And just that's how bad she missed her husband, how much she missed him. Very sad situations, but, you know, that's it's part of the job. You know, it's part of what I do. Some medics I don't think would do that, but I do it. It's just who, it's what I do. So we've done 2 minutes of CPR, and it will analyze again.
Push, analyze.
So this
analyzing now. Stand clear.
This voice doesn't give up.
No, it doesn't.
No shock advised.
Wait a second.
Start CPR.
No shock advised. What happened?
The rhythm converted. So what happened was while they were doing CPR, there was enough perfusion to where they were able to get the heart pumping on its own again. At this point, we would check for a pulse, and we would continue to stabilize and start transporting.
So just when we were talking about what happens when it's too late, in this case, this hypothetical person kicked in.
Mm-hmm. A lot of times they will, and those arrhythmias of VTAC especially. And sometimes in VFib, you'll get a response. But
and so this is what, 10 minutes worth of CPR and shocks, roughly, before this person?
It was actually 6 minutes of CPR and 3 shocks.
And that CPR could keep people alive then, or give them a chance to live, mm-hmm. Past the point that they'd be brain dead.
Correct, because what's happening is you're perfusing, you're priming the pump. New guidelines through American Heart and studies through American Heart Association have proven that the longer that CPR is done, the higher the chances of survival.
As for our anonymous heart attack survivor, he says his experience went like this.
Emergency rescue came. I mean, they came right in the motel lobby, and they... I don't exactly remember. They gave me nitro and put me in a stretcher, and they took me or whatever, and they put me in the emergency rescue truck, and they drove me right to Boulder Community Hospital on Broadway. They zipped me right in. They were waiting for me. They apparently cut my clothes off with the scissors. My wife told me I was out of it by then because they had drugged me. My wife came down, met me at the hospital. I went right into the operating room, and they gave me a stint. That was it. And I was very fortunate because there was no damage. They got it right away before there was any kind of damage to the heart or the heart muscle. So that's basically my story.
As for why he got his heart attack and how he could have prevented it, the medical director of Boulder's Front Range Preventative Imaging Center, Dr. Bill Blanchette, is one that believes that if someone's never had a heart attack, most cholesterol tests won't tell you much.
They did a study a couple of years ago in the American Heart Journal looking at 103,000 people presenting with heart attacks. Found out that somewhere over 70% of them had normal cholesterol. These are people with heart attacks. They also at the same time looked at 48,000 people presenting without heart attacks. Their cholesterol was the same as the people who presented with heart attacks. So using cholesterol to screen who's going to have a heart attack and who's not is silly. But yet, that's what we do, and it's just plain silly. You know, it's kind of the exception when the person has an LDL cholesterol of 200 and something and doesn't have heart disease. If your cholesterol is substantially elevated, that should grab your attention. But if your cholesterol is normal, that's not a get-out-of-jail-free card. You still have risk for heart disease.
Blanchette believes a better prevention test is a heart scan to check for calcium buildup in the arteries. Calcium buildup is a sign that there's been irritation in your arteries and they've ended up with a buildup of waxy stuff called plaque. And since most heart attacks involve unstable plaque that breaks off and causes a blood clot, plaque buildup really is an issue. So much of an issue, a former president of the American Heart Association has said that calcium heart scans are a very helpful tool. Bob Eckel is a professor at the CU School of Medicine. He headed up the American Heart Association in 2005, and he's served on many of its advisory panels since.
Well, let's start cheap, and I'd get a fasting lipid panel.
Well, let's start expensive. Let's say money's no object.
Well, I'd get a coronary calcium score.
That would be your top choice.
Well, right, because it's coronary artery disease. Almost nobody with zero calcium scores have events. And the level of calcium in the coronary artery does predict the amount of disease burden, and it's a good predictor of events.
A lot of doctors warn that being overweight is a big risk factor, but there's actually some disagreement. Here's former Denver doctor Ron Rosedale, who now runs an educational site about health.
Certainly lots and lots of skinny people have died of heart attacks. There's something else. It's not the fact that you were overweight or that you were obese, but how you got there. If you got there just because you overate and it got stored appropriately without impacting insulin or leptin, then you're probably not really going to be in harm's way so much.
Ron Rosedale says that measuring fasting levels of hormones such as leptin and insulin can tell you a lot about your risk for heart disease. Another way is to put a tape measure around your belly and your hips. In women, your waist should be smaller than your hips. And men, your belly shouldn't be any bigger than your hips. Our anonymous heart attack survivor. So what was his risk?
I had gone to the dentist a week before. I had a tooth extracted. The blood from your mouth that picks up bacteria. And so apparently I got an embolism from that source. So now once you've had a heart attack, every time you go to the dentist, you take amoxicillin to make sure it kills anything in your mouth while the dentist is working on your teeth.
For our anonymous heart attack survivor, after he told his story, he made a point of calling up and saying he wanted to share with you one more thing.
So on the karma piece, you know, there I was 5 minutes from the motel when I realized what was happening. Got emergency services immediately. They were waiting for me at the hospital when I got there. You know, it can't get any better than that, you know. I could have been at home in bed, you know, 45 minutes away in the mountains. Or I could have been on an airplane, or I could have been hiking in Estes Park, you know, or, you know, you're vacationing in a big city and you're in the subway or they rush you to the hospital and you're sitting in the ER for an hour before they can get you in and do anything for you. That's why Boulder's such a great city. I can only say the best for the Boulder Community Hospital and their services and the what are the emergency services people, the ambulance people. I mean, it's, you know, terrific. An acquaintance of mine didn't realize what was happening to him. Waited a couple days, felt real bad. Didn't want to call an ambulance because he didn't want to pay the money for and figured the ambulance would cost him $200. Called his friend, had him drive to the ER. He lost 70% of his heart muscle. He's only got 30% left. His whole life has changed. He's, you know, on disability now. After all, as Carlos Castaneda says, death is watching you over your left shoulder. And when you're aware of that, you can lead a more impeccable life, hopefully, moment to moment.
That's the end of part one of the Heart Attack Chronicles. Tune in tomorrow at 3 p.m. for part two. Thanks to local musicians Paul Harris and Sheldon Sands for helping us with today's music. For more on this program, go to kgnu.org/metro. For KGNU, I'm Shelley Schlender.